on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today in beautiful Carmel, California, with George W. Dubois, a native of Visalia, California. He just celebrated his 90th birthday. But way back when he was just a teenager, he volunteered to be a paratrooper in World War II. We've had paratroopers on this program who made jumps in the war with airborne units like the 82nd or the 101st or the 17th Airborne that made a name for itself at Operation Varsity, that airborne assault over the Rhine River in Germany. And Mr. Dubois, you might have been part of that if things had gone the way you planned. You'd been in paratrooper training for quite a while at this point. Tell me what happened.
They took the guys in my unit and put them over there in the 17th, and they shipped out to Europe. I didn't go because I'd had artillery basic instead of infantry basic. And so, you know how the Army is. They go by the numbers. So it didn't make a bit of sense because I'd been in the parachute infantry for a year. But that's just the breaks of the game.
For you at the time, I'm sure you can look back now and say, hey, maybe it's a good thing I never went over there. I'm still here. I'm in great shape at age 90. But at the time, were you upset about that? Was it hard to swallow? Were you frustrated?
Well, I just couldn't understand it. But gee whiz, the life was so nice. Here I was a second lieutenant and at the parachute school and didn't have any. I had about an hour duty a day. And the rest of the time in the summertime, I spent it at the swimming pool there at the officers' club. And so I couldn't complain.
But you did have occasion to laugh a little bit. You've got a pretty good story about a sergeant who challenged the wrong group of paratroopers, or at least one of them in particular.
Okay, so when I graduated from the parachute school, they sent us to North Carolina there at Camp McCall. The first morning, we lined up there, being in alphabetical order with a last name of D, I was in the front row. And about two guys down behind me was Nick Bosnick from San Francisco. And he was about 6'2", 215 pounds. And he was a professional boxer. So we all lined up, and here comes our little sergeant. And that little sergeant had combat experience, so he thought he was really something else. So he stood up in front of us and says, okay, you guys, I'm going to kick you into shape, and I don't want any lip from any of you guys. And if any of you guys think you're tougher than I am, just take two steps forward. Well, here old Nick Bosnick, big grin on his face, he takes two steps forward. And the sergeant comes over and says, well, let's see what you got. And he took a swing at Nick, and Nick just dodged him, gave him a right cross, and he flattened him right out on the ground. And he stayed there. And so they went into the orderly room, and they got a stretcher and came out, and they hauled him off. We never saw him again. But what a mistake to stand up in front of 36 paratroopers and challenge the whole thing. I thought, boy, he sure learned a hard lesson. But that's one of my favorite stories, Nick Bosnick. And then Nick and I were going to Fort Benning to go to the officer school. And every time you change station, you have to take a physical. Well, they found Nick had a heart murmur. So he got, not only didn't have to go there, he got a discharge. Went back to San Francisco and made a bunch of money boxing. So that's the way it goes in the Army.
Not fit enough to serve in the Army, but he could tear up everyone in the ring, huh?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? And Dick was a really good guy, too. He was a professional boxer, but, gee, he never tried to push anybody around. He was just a real nice kind of guy.
So challenging Nick could be hazardous to your health, but even without enemy fire, just those practice jumps in daylight and in the dark of night, and, of course, all the demonstration jumps you made with those old parachutes, they all had some inherent danger, didn't they?
Oh, I landed in a tree one time because the Air Corps gave us the green light before we got to the landing zone. But I was lucky. I landed in the tree, and my feet touched the ground, and I came back off about a foot. And so all I had to do was unhook and drop down a foot, and I was going with the rest of them. Yeah, but some of them would get broken ankles and broken backs and everything else and landing in the wrong place. And I was fortunate enough not to have had any more trouble than that. We landed in a field down in Florida one time, and it was a sandy field where they were growing cotton. The cotton was about a foot tall. And, geez, it was just soft ground. That was the best jump I ever made. But a lot of those jumps were, you come down like a ton of bricks, because we just had a little old 28-foot chute in those days, just a round chute with a hole in the top. And with all the equipment, all you just come down really hard. So fortunately, I didn't break anything, but I couldn't get into combat no matter what I did.
You mentioned, though, that you made a lot of demonstration jumps. Maybe you can explain the purpose of those jumps, what you guys were doing, and what they accomplished. And when you did those, did you get a little more nervous knowing who was watching?
No, not really. When I was in that unit there is making demonstration jumps, I was just a private at that time. So they would get the guys, the big brass from other countries too, and the generals and the majors and all. And they would have them in the bleachers, and we would land in this nice open field in front of them. So then demonstrate airborne tactics, putting machine guns together and mortars and all like that, and so that they could kind of see how the airborne tactics could be a big advantage in their own situations there. And that was our purpose, was to just show these generals what paratroopers could do.
And you mentioned you hadn't gone overseas with the 17th Airborne, but now, after finishing Officer Candidate School, I bet you thought you were about to be deployed.
Gee, I had no idea. I thought I'd go 82nd or the 101st or somebody. And I don't know why I was assigned to the parachute school as an instructor. And the other guys, there was five of us in my class, and we graduated 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in our class, by the way. And those guys all went to the 82nd and 101st there in Europe, and here I go to the parachute school, and I don't know why. I have no idea.
And what did the training consist of that you were carrying out? What were you teaching them how to do?
Mostly the physical part. The parachute school, the first 2 weeks is strictly physical. It's the running and the push-ups and the pull-ups and the sports marches and all that. And gee, over half of them don't get through the first week. I was in great shape. I was only about 19. And I'd been on the track team there in school. And so I was in great shape, and it didn't bother me. But there was a lot of guys that would like to be heroes, but they didn't have what it took to hack the physical part of it. And so my job was just to handle the physical training part of it. You get up on a platform there, and all these guys are down there, and you just direct them in their push-ups and all kinds of exercises like that.
Were you pretty demanding in that role? Were you an intimidating kind of figure to them, do you think?
No, I just was just doing the job. If they could make it, fine. If they couldn't, why, I didn't have any animosity toward anybody. They either qualified or made it or they didn't, and I didn't really care which way.
And you mentioned going overseas, but I think you did something else before you went overseas. So you're still here stateside. You're at Fort Benning, and you get the news that this is over. Japan has surrendered. How did that play out on the base there?
Well, of course, everybody was happy the war was over. And so I thought, well, gee whiz, the war's over. So now I can get married, because I'm not going to get killed. And so went back to Visay, and Judy and I got married.
When had you actually figured out, hey, she's not that little freshman anymore, this is someone that I might think about spending my life with?
Yeah, I had leaves along the way, you know, and so I would always go back to Visay, and a lot of the guys were gone, a lot of the girls were gone too, and so I remembered that little Judy Dwight. And so I didn't have a date one night, Saturday night. And so my sister Jean says, well, why don't you ask Judy Dwight? And I said, oh, she's too young. And she said, well, that was 3 years ago. She's a senior now. So I called her up and asked her for a date to go to the dance there at the Sierra. And so we hit it off really good. So it just went from there.
So you think, well, I haven't wanted to make any rash decisions or long-lasting commitments, but now that the war's over, I'm not going anywhere. It's safe to get married, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I thought, well, we'll just sweat it out here until I get a discharge, and then that'll be it. And then I just went out to the base there after coming back from Visay, and here was orders to go to the 82nd Airborne in Germany, and they were up in Frankfurt at that time. So I went overseas in the SS United States. It was one of the premier civilian liners at that time, and it only took us 5 days from New York to Le Havre. And it was a really, really nice ship. So I had 36 guys, and we loaded into the train there and had two boxcars. And when we got to Munich, they needed officers real bad to take care of the prisoner of war camps. And the rumor was that, gee, the duty was awfully nice. You have your own jeep and everything. And so I said, well, okay, I'll do that. I've had enough parachute jumping to last me a lifetime. And the other guys, then they went on up to the 82nd up there in Frankfurt. And I stayed there, and there were three other officers that decided to do that. So we got assigned to these different prisoner of war camps. So we had to have a place to live. And so we went to the Burgermeister, and we got a list of the Nazi party members and their address. So we went house hunting, and we found a house that we liked. It was a nice two-story house. So we told them, you got 3 days to get out. And the reason is, you lost the war. So we did. We just moved them out, and we went into the nice house. We each had our own bedroom, and it was a heck of a deal. Fireplaces and the whole shot. That's the way I spent 9 months there in Germany. The prisoners of war there, we had pretty nice buildings there. And plenty of firewood, so they stayed warm during the wintertime.
How many prisoners were under your supervision?
About 1,400. We treated them really nice, too. They had plenty of food and shelter. And one guy escaped. And 4 days later, he was back at the gate wanting to get back in because he was cold and hungry, and the border guards beat him up. And so he came back. It was a lot nicer in the prisoner of war camps than it was outside. He had looked like blood poisoning or something on one arm. It didn't look good to me, so I sent him to the hospital. But we didn't have much trouble with guys escaping because conditions were really nice there. And, you know, the regular German people, they didn't have enough food to eat, and they didn't have much shelter either. And so those prisoners there were treated a lot better than if they were out in civilian life.
Did you get a sense for who these prisoners were? I mean, were these the rake and file of the Wehrmacht, or I mean, were these high-ranking officers? Did you have any idea of who was imprisoned there?
No, they were mostly just the regular old infantry guys in the regular German army. We didn't have any high brass that I knew of. So I got orders to allow a Russian interrogation team to go through my guys. I wasn't sure what that was for, and so they showed up. And there was five of them, and they went through and interrogated every one of my prisoners. And they took four or five of them. They says, well, where are you taking them? Well, back to Russia. And I couldn't understand it. And boy, they were really sad sacks. They were giving their rings away and shoes and everything. They knew they wouldn't last out the day. And what happened was when Hitler started going into Russia, gee, things were tough in Russia. The German army was coming through, and boy, they had lots of food and everything. And so some of the Russians, they deserted, and they went over and joined the German troops. Well, then when they got bogged down and then they got captured, the Russian guys ended up in my prisoner of war camp, but they were out and out deserters. And those were the guys that the Russians wanted to get. They didn't go for this deserting business. And so they came through and took those guys. And there wasn't anything I could do about it because I had my orders to let them take anybody they wanted.
I think a lot of people would be curious what your interactions were like with these guys, because obviously there was no love lost politically at that time, and you're fighting a war against an enemy that we know now was murdering Jews by the millions and committing all these atrocities over there. But when you looked one of those German prisoners in the eyes, what did you see?
I just felt that those guys really were just kind of like I was. They just got them in the army, and they probably didn't know much about the politics or anything else, and they were just guys in a German army that doing the best they could. And so I didn't really have any animosity toward those guys, and they seemed like pretty good guys. And they were all from civilian life, too, originally. And one of them was a shoemaker, a bootmaker. So he made me a pair of custom ski boots. And another one was a metal worker, and he put a metal top on my Jeep and side doors and everything like that. And so I thought they were pretty good guys. Of course, you can't tell by talking to a guy what he did, but most of them were just plain old German army guys just doing their job.
So on weekends, you would go skiing in a pair of custom ski boots made by a German prisoner of war?
Right, and we, And we had, in Garmisch, there was two hotels, one for the enlisted men and one for the officers. I would go skiing every weekend there, and we would go up to the top of the Zugspitz Mountain and come back down.
Sounds like quite the adventure, and some car buffs might be interested to know that your office during that time was in what had been the BMW factory, and that wasn't too far from one of the infamous spots where atrocities had been carried out against prisoners of the Nazi regime. We're going to find out how Mr. Dubois got up close and personal with that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.